Assistant Senator Wilkin and myself, Senator Kukesh.
And this is Senator Cowdery, and I'm online too.
Oh, good. Thank you, Senator Cowdery. Glad you could make it.
Yeah.
And we do have an adequate number to do business for the Transportation Committee. The first bill we have on the docket today is Senate Bill 218, an act relating to the use of child safety seats and seat belts. Senator French isn't here, but would you like to step forward and identify yourself for the record, please, and give us your testimony?
Thank you.
Senator Cowdery, you can't see it, but we have two displays here. One is a Graco seat, child seat. Why don't you describe what you have?
Yeah. Certainly.
And for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Allison Biostock, staff to Senator Hollis French. And if I might say, Senator French, I'm sure wishes he could be here. He's unfortunately out of Juneau for family medical reasons. And for those who can't see, I do have two booster seats with me, a backless and a full-back model, which I will explain here in a moment. When children use adult seat belts in place of the proper child safety device, injuries can occur. While any restraint is better than no restraint, the use of proper child safety seats and boosters can prevent injuries. Current Alaska law states that children under 4 must be secured in a safety device meeting U.S. Department of Transportation standards. SB 218 places the United States DOT guidelines into statute. And if you would like to take a look at the color chart in your packet, it does a good job of outlining what child would belong in which device.
Oh, it's in the additional packet?
I do have some extra copies.
Here's the additional. It's in this one, Gary. Yeah.
The major change in statute would be the requirement that children ages 4 to 8 who do not meet height and weight requirements need to use a seatbelt secured booster seat or approved child passenger restraint. Booster seats are, in essence, big kid car seats. In most cases, when children outgrow their child seat, they are too small for an adult seatbelt. The American Academy of Pediatrics states that booster seats are 60% safer than seatbelts alone. 38 states currently mandate booster seat use. I have two models of boosters here, both of which would put a driver into compliance with the language in SB 218. This backless model sells for about $14 to $25, and the full-back model for about $40. Noteworthy is that both models are less than a tank of gas for most vehicles. And the CS before you clarifies the age at which a child would use a booster seat. The original bill, you might have a 15-year-old who is small for their age who would be required by law to use a booster seat, and we didn't know how realistic that might have been. So the CS makes it so a booster seat is mandatory for kids 4 to 8 who do not meet height and weight requirements. If a child is over 8, but it's up to the parent or guardian to use a child restraint device or a seatbelt, whichever is appropriate. We thought that might also help with law enforcement, since they could simply ask the age of a child in a vehicle as opposed to sizing them up. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'd like to note that we have some child passenger safety experts online, as well as Rodney Dial with the Department of Public Safety.
Any questions for the presenter?
Yes.
Senator Wilikowski. Senator Wilikowski, then I'll recognize you, Senator Cowdery.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Okay, Senator Cowdery.
Is there confusion about the present law?
I'm sorry?
Is there some confusion about the present law that we have about seatbelts for children?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, the present law is written in rather vague terms, and I know that perhaps Lieutenant Dial could address that better than I, so I might defer to him on that point.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Dial, could you go ahead and answer the question for Senator Cowdery?
Yes, I am online. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rodney Dial, Lieutenant with the Department of Public Safety. And the problem that we experience at most parents is some law enforcement officers simply do not know which children should booster seats. And currently, the specifications are not mentioned in the last statute references to the standard.
Excuse me, you're really breaking up. I don't know whether our equipment is too loud, or maybe we should turn down your mic, or maybe you can back away from your mic just a little. We're hearing every other word you're saying.
Is this a little bit better?
And maybe slow down just a little bit.
Is
Okay, go ahead, try it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, is any better?
Well, why don't you say something besides is it any better? Maybe we'll check here. go ahead and give us your testimony. We'll stop you if we still can't hear you.
Yes, Chairman. This is Lieutenant Dial with the troopers. The problem that we experience, most parents and some law enforcement officers simply do not know which children should get boosters and which those are acceptable. We think that this makes it as clear as we believe it. Parents and law enforcement to determine what is strength is for children. Parents' specifications are not mentioned in Alaska statute, which only references to.
Excuse me, can you pick up the handset instead of using a speakerphone?
Mr. Chairman, how about if I just call back? We have a bad connection.
Yeah, we really do have a bad connection, but could you do it right a minute? We'll wait for you to call right back in.
All right, thank you.
Let's just be at ease for a second here. Go ahead, Lieutenant Dial.
Yes, regarding Senate Bill 218. The Department of Public Safety supports the bill. The problem that we experience is that most parents and some law enforcement officers simply do not know which children should be in booster seats and when seatbelts are acceptable. We think that this makes it as clear as we believe is reasonably possible for parents and law enforcement to determine what is the appropriate restraint for their children. So we answer Senator Padre's question. We experience a lot of parents out there who just simply do not know what's acceptable. We feel this will help.
Okay, thank you, Senator Wilkowski. You had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to figure out the difference between current law and what you're proposing to do. Could you just briefly explain that?
Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Before Lieutenant Dowell gets off, I'd have him a question. Unless you want to go into this question first.
Do you have any, Senator Wilkins? Go ahead. Let's go ahead and finish up with Lieutenant Dial and Senator Olson.
I'm just afraid we're going to lose him. Yeah. Lieutenant Dial, as you're giving your testimony, the confusion that's out there, I mean, is this something widespread or is this something that is only occasionally brought up?
Chair, Senator Olson, I believe it's really widespread, completely honest with you. Most parents do know young children, infants should be in a seat. However, certain to the state boost seats are involved, become much more problematic.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. For the sponsor, could you just briefly explain what current law requires and what this law will require, the difference between the two?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, current law states that a child under the age of 16 shall be properly secured in a child safety device, and further, if the child is less than 4 years of age, the child shall be properly secured in a safety device meeting the standards of the USDOT. What this bill does is places the guidelines from the USDOT precisely into statute, and that's where you get the chart. It should be that wherever you're, however old your child is or whatever their size, you can plug them into this and find out what type of seat they should be in. For example, an infant who is under 1 year or over a year and under 20 pounds should be in a rear-facing car seat. That's not currently spelled out in statute, but with this bill it would be.
So if I could, so currently parents are required to adhere to SB 218, but it's just not as clear. Is that or less
through
understanding?
Through the chair, Sunny Wilikowski, it is my understanding that there has been some difficulty because it is not clearly lined out in enforcing the law.
I don't, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski, go ahead.
Looks like you don't see this too often, but if we pass this bill, looks like we actually have a fiscal gain. Looks like we actually get money from the federal government. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that is my understanding, and I know Sandy Cashin with the Department of Transportation is here to address that.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee or the sponsor?
Yes. Actually, I do, Mr. Chairman, what do you do in the case of a pickup truck where you don't have a rear seat, and especially if you don't have the extended cab, or even the older pickup trucks that don't have seat belts at all? Does this bill have any effect on that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, there are a list of exemptions, and one of the exemptions is a vehicle that is not equipped with seat belts, and you may not remove seat belts to make that vehicle compliant. So older vehicles without seat belts would not be able to have a child safety device that is secured with a seat belt. As far as a cab with no back seats, I believe as long as it's secured with a seat belt, that is compliant.
Okay, but that's not part of this bill, is it? It's already in statute.
Through the chair, you are correct, Senator Olson. Those exemptions are in statute.
Thank you. One more question, Mr. Chairman. The other thing is I don't have the current statute in front of me here, and was wondering what were the exemptions? Are there exemptions for rural areas or non-federally funded highway areas like that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, there are no current rural exemptions in child passenger restraint in law, and this bill would not change that. However, I would like to note that vehicles that are not designed to be on a highway, such as ATVs and snow machines, this would not apply to them.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue. So if you have a pickup truck or a vehicle, which are getting more and more popular out in the villages that really don't have any rules but do run up and down the beach at low tide and issues, and even across the airport for that matter, those people would be in violation of this law?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that is my understanding, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions for the presenter? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the junior audience that would like to present on this bill? Yes, would you please come forward and state your name for the record? And your position for the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cindy Cashin, and I am the administrator for the Alaska Highway Safety Office. My office is located in the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, the Planning Division. Right behind me. My office is responsible for administering the federal transportation dollars to effective programs that save lives and prevent injuries on our roads. There are federal funds called Child Safety and Booster Seat Incentive Grants that are available to states that are enforcing a law requiring any child riding in a passenger vehicle, which is too large to be secured in a child safety seat, to be secured in a child restraint that meets the requirement prescribed under Section 3 of Anton's Law. To qualify for a grant under this program, a state child restraint law must not leave any gaps in coverage for children under 8 years old. And that's gaps would be, for instance, coverage between a child safety seat and a child booster seat. The current Alaska law requires the use of proper safety devices for children under the age of 16. As approved by the U.S. Department of Transportation, but does not include which safety device must be used based on a child's age, height, and weight. And the federal government has determined that if states want these funds, they need to have this law specify the child's age, height, and weight. It used to be just the age. The U.S. Department of Transportation's chief counsel has determined that Alaska would be eligible to receive new federal funds with the passage of Senate Bill 281A. Alaska could apply for an estimated $194,000 in federal fiscal year 08 and another $194,000 in federal fiscal year 09. Up to 50% of those funds may be used to fund programs for purchasing and distributing child safety seats and restraints to low-income families. And the remaining amount, remaining 50%, would be for enforcement, education, training of child passenger safety professionals, police officers, fire and emergency medical personnel, educators, and parents concerning all the aspects of the use of child safety seats and restraints, and educating the public concerning the proper use and installation of child safety seats and child restraints. That about does it. So are there any questions?
Could you go back up just a little bit? Did you say 281 in your testimony?
I think you said 281A.
I'm sorry, 218A.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Just for the record, just want to make sure that we're correct on that.
Thank you.
Any questions for the presenter?
Yes.
Senator Wilkowski. Oh, Senator Cowdery?
Yeah, I was wondering, I have a neighbor that has child and also drives a sports car, a single seat, getting back to what Senator Oval said. How do you address that and still comply? Just one seat, you know, one seat car, one seat.
So, with Senate Bill 218, it would specify what type of child restraint or child safety device the child would need to be restrained in. It would spell it out in a more understandable way.
But it wouldn't be in the back seat, right?
Under 8 years old, yes.
Well, what if you don't have a back seat? That's my question.
If you don't have a back seat, then the child should not be in the vehicle.
So if you've got a pickup truck or a sports car,
Cindy, this is Gordon. Would you like me to respond to that?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy, for understanding who is the chair to your response. I think the question was, is what do you do if you have a sports car like a Corvette or and I only know this by reputation or a Porsche with a child safety seat. My name is Gordon Glazer. I work with the State of Alaska Department of Public Health and the Section of Injury Prevention and Emergency Medical Services. My focus is injury prevention programs with children. What happens there is that there is an on-off switch in the front seat which turns off the airbag. In that case, you can put a child seat in the front. This is the legislation putting in the back seat, which is the guidelines from the Department of Health, Department of Transportation, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is to put them in the back seat until their 13th birthday if that seat is available. If there's no seat available, they're put in the front seat, and all cars which have airbags, and all new cars do, have an on-off switch to disable that front airbag so that a car seat can be placed there. I'm sorry for the interruption, Cindy.
Thank you. I didn't know that.
Senator Wilkowski, please, and then Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it, do you know the administration's intent to, if we do get that $194,000, to put that in the budget to use for the purposes that you talked about? I know sometimes you get federal money and then it just kind of goes into the general fund and used for other things.
Through the chair, thank you for allowing me to clarify that those funds would stay within our office, the Alaska Highway Safety Office. And they are funded directly towards those types of programs, the child restraint programs. Safety is always a concern of our departments.
Senator Olson?
Senator
Cowdery?
Does the funds go directly to you, or does it go to the legislature to be appropriated?
Does the funds go directly to your department, or do they go to the legislature to be reappropriated?
That's
Chairman, Nancy Slagle, with the Director of the Division of Administrative Services with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, that you would be appropriating the funds to the department for us, for our use.
Oh, I see.
Okay?
So that would be earmarked for your department?
Would it be earmarked for your department?
Mr. Chairman, they would be provided to us for us to determine where the grants would be provided at, mm-hmm. or where the funds would be provided, whether it was through a grant award process to local nonprofits, or whether we would be providing the monies to, say, the troopers for enforcement purposes, or that type of thing.
Okay, thank you.
The legislature is the only one that has power to appropriate.
That is
correct,
Senator.
Okay. Thank
you. Senator
Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this question goes back to Mr. Glazier. It has to do with the follow-up to the question that that Senator Cowdery asked, and that had to do with these airbags that are in these sports cars. There are some sports cars that don't have this on-off switch. And are we in violation if I am to take my little 14-month-old boy in there? Here's the example specifically. And I have to say that I do have a conflict here. I got a DeLorean that is there, and I enjoy taking him out there, but it sounds like I'm in violation because of this laws like this. Is that correct, Mr. Glazier?
The chair to Calgary. I envy you for having the Delorean. That is a classic car. My guess is it's a little bit of an older car, and it does not have a passenger side airbag. All the cars that have passenger side airbag have an on-off switch, either which is manually operated, or some of the more sophisticated ones have a system where they see if the seatbelts are on, whether it's the weight of the child, an infrared system. The Orion is a classic car. It's a wonderful car. Make sure nobody parks near you. But I don't believe there is an airbag on the passenger side, so you would not be in violation.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just continue, I guess I failed to qualify that there were, it was retrofitted with airbags. And as I remember, I don't ever see a switch on there. But I just was wondering if that is the case, then. I guess the concern that I have is that, you know, if everything is toward the child safety issue, and if that's the case, leave them home and don't take them out with a car. So I guess I'm a little concerned from that standpoint, is that we're saving ourselves from ourselves. And because of that, I just want to make sure if I do get stopped that I do have everything in order, or at least know what the law is.
Let me clarify something and put it in a very concrete terms. There was a case in Alaska where we had a death by an airbag. And to put it bluntly, a rear-facing car seat cannot be in front of a frontal airbag that is locked. I don't know the people who did your retrofit of your DeLorean. I applaud you for putting an airbag because they are safer. I have the trust, and it might be worthwhile finding out, that there is the automatic system or there is a switch. That's for your safety and the safety of your passengers. Again, these laws are meant based on the experience that we've had checked in car seats literally from the North Pole to the Ketchikan area to make sure children are safe. And again, we've had instances on that. Again, I can't say specific to a retrofit. Anybody who has a standard American car or has been retrofitted by a common mechanic, if they have a frontal airbag and no rear seat, will have an on-off switch.
Thank you, Mr. Glazier.
Thank you. Any other questions for the presenter? If not, thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to make a presentation to the committee? State your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Brenda Knapp, and I'm a health program manager with the Division of Public Health, Injury Prevention, and Emergency Medical Services section. And I'm here to offer testimony on behalf of the Department of Health and Social Services. And if there are follow-up questions, I'm very glad to know that Mr. Glazier is online because he is the division's expert in this arena. The Department of Health and Social Services supports Senate Bill 218, the Child Safety Seats and Seatbelt Bill. This bill amends current statute to set specific standards for the use of child passenger restraints. Motor vehicle-related injuries are the leading cause of death in the United States of children between 2 and 14, and one of the leading causes of hospitalization of Alaska children. Children who are restrained in booster seats are 59% less likely to be injured in a crash than children restrained by a lap belt only. Nationally, voluntary seatbelt inspection stations report that 80 to 85% of children are improperly restrained, and one-third of children under age 14 use the wrong type of restraint. The current statute references child safety devices, but does not state specific standards for age and weight-based restraints. This bill is designed to eliminate confusion about which restraints are appropriate for each age weight level. It clarifies the types of passenger restraints required by children of various ages and sizes to prevent and minimize vehicular injuries. Currently, 42 states have passed booster seat legislation qualifying them for U.S. Department of Transportation highway safety grants. While this bill has no fiscal impact on DHSS, Alaska would be eligible for approximately $200,000 in additional federal incentive funds for education and enforcement if this legislation passes. The money would go to the Highway Safety Office and the State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, obviously, if the legislature appropriates it. And that is all I have to offer.
Thank you. Any questions for the presenter?
Yes, this is Senator Calvary.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
If a family, the only means of transportation was, say, a dump truck, which is single seat, this seems like a little bit of gray area, and I was just wondering if this bill completely addressed like
the DeLorean and older vehicles that don't have airbags and things and single seats. Do you want to answer it, or
would you like someone else to step up? Perhaps if Mr. Glazier's online.
Mr. Glazier, would you please step forward and maybe answer the question for us?
I think it's a good question.
For the record, please.
I'm sorry. My name is Gordon Glazier. I work with the State Division of Public Health Prevention and Emergency Medical Services. My focus is injury prevention programs for children. This bill, I think, fairly addresses the question of older cars. Most people do not take the steps you take, which is putting in an airbag. A fairly expensive proposition, well over $1,000 to put in into a car. The issue of the dump truck is, and again, same problem we have with everybody else with trucking seatbelts. If you only have two seatbelts, you can only put two people in. And with the family of the dump truck, that is problematic. I will say this, children do need to be restrained. And they are off in many of our communities when you have more children than you have spaces in your car. That's beyond the purview of this bill. This bill is really more of making the present law clear so that law enforcement and caregivers and parents are able to make choice. Nothing is as tragic as a parent to call us up and say, my child is hurt. I didn't know they needed to be in a booster seat. And, or law enforcement saying, I stopped someone and I don't know whether they should be in a booster seat or a car seat. This is meant to make the law, not to change it, not even make it stronger, but to make it clear so people can understand. There really is no difference in terms of the law now, except that people will understand. I hope I correctly answered your question.
Well, this Senator Cowdery, I just wanted to make it absolutely clear. If somebody had a pickup truck that was equipped with seatbelts, and that's your only mode of transportation, which I think there's a lot of them on the road today.
Oh, right. If the pickup truck did not come with seatbelts, then there's no requirement to put seatbelts in. You are not allowed to remove the seatbelt so you can put more people in. But if it didn't come with seatbelts, you're not required to put seatbelts in. Any American car or American truck that has an airbag and no seating positions in the back will have an on-off switch.
I guess you're missing the point. I'm talking about those vehicles that didn't come with.
If they didn't come with seatbelts, there's no requirement in this law to put them in or to use a car seat.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Olson?
Continuing on with Senator Cowdery's question about, and I think it has to do with dealing with heavy equipment. What about if you have, once in a while I take my kid in my loader and forklift out there? Does this bill have to do with just passenger vehicles, or does it have an effect on that as well?
That's my understanding.
To my knowledge, this would not have an effect on industrial, like a forklift or a grader,
loader,
or a tractor for that matter.
You mean?
This is meant for vehicles that are on and actually cars, trucks, vans. Doesn't it have an impact on motorcycles, snow machines, etc.?
Okay, Senator Wilkowski.
As I understand this, and maybe someone can correct me if I'm wrong, this bill doesn't really change what current law is.
That's correct.
Current law says that a child has to be in a device approved by the United States Department of Transportation. And all this, as I understand this law, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, we're just codifying what those regulations are and getting $200,000 to do that. Am I wrong here? We're not excluding pickups or including pickups. We're not changing the law in that regard at all.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
If I may, the existing statute references the standards in the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, but this would bring those standards into law so that they're in the law and readable and usable without having to go reference and research another set of standards. Thank you.
Any more questions for the presenter? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience that would like to testify? If not, we're going to go online, and I'd like to go first to Anchorage to John Cook with the Alaska Auto Dealer Association.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Cook. I'm the legislative director for the Alaska Automobile Dealers Association, and our organization has passed a resolution in support of Senate Bill 218. The bill just essentially, as others have testified, clarifies the law and takes into account the advances in safety restraint systems that have taken place in automobiles over the last 15 to 20 years and helps eliminate confusion. And I can testify to the fact that having held inspections where we've had professionals come in to see if booster seats or infant seats have been installed correctly, that there's just a lot of confusion that is out there. So that's something I can personally attest to. Regarding some of the other questions, I guess, that have occurred in the course of testimony, I've got, looking at Senate Bill 218, it does just specifically relate to motor vehicles, not any types of other vehicles or heavy equipment or anything of that nature. It really helps bring state regulation in line with what the manufacturers recommend with regard to children inside of, in vehicles. But I guess I can just read you a real quick excerpt, and this is kind of standard verbiage that you'll get out of just nearly any manufacturer. This is out of the General Motors Sierra owner's manual I have for my 2007 truck. It just says airbags plus lap shoulder belts offer protection for adults and older children, but not for younger children and infants. Neither the vehicle's safety belt system nor its airbag system is designed for them. Young children and infants need the protection that a child restraint system can provide. And that's pretty much standard verbiage that you'll get out of any manufacturer. As to the difference between a regular cab and an extended cab truck, you know, the manufacturers do provide provisions for attaching booster seats and or infant seats to an extended cab or regular cab truck. There's latches on the seats, whether it's the front seat or the second seat. It's just, it's not recommended. And also, it's previously been testified. Every vehicle that's been produced in the last 8 or so years that's manufactured with airbags either has, as Gordon mentioned, in the trucks, the on-off switch, or many of them, my own truck included, has a sensor that automatically detects if the latch system's being used or if it's too light of an individual and it disables the airbag. So again, we would just like to offer our support to this bill. It's a good bill. It doesn't provide any, you know, doesn't really add to any new laws. It just clarifies existing ones that are on the books. And I'm available for questions if anyone has any.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cook? No. Well, thank you very much for your presentation today. We'll go now to the Kenai LIO and ask Jane Feldman, who is with the Safe Kids Kenai Peninsula, if she would like to make a presentation.
Yes, thank you. My name is Jane Feldman. I'm a registered nurse at Central Peninsula Hospital, coordinator of the local Safe Kids Coalition down here. And part of my function is health passenger safety. On a day-to-day basis, I do child passenger safety. Is that echoing? And checking car seats, doing educational programs for people. And this clarification is very much needed on a practical standpoint. In 2000, we started looking at how do we get this clarified. And in 2003, we went to Senator Seaton, and he wrote the commissioner at that time asking for clarification on the law. And it came back in the fact that, yes, Alaska had a very good law. It said according to federal standard when children were over the age of 4. Well, the problem is that how do you enforce it? How do you get the information out there? On a weekly basis, I have people call me and say, what does the state law say about children over the age of 4? Do they really have to be in booster seats? Well, yes, they do. And then you have to go into detail about what that means because it's not in black and white. We've done training programs for the law enforcement going over what does it mean and how do you get a kid in a booster seat, who should be in the booster seat, height and weight and proper fit. But it's not clear. And it has even with the education, even with us going into the school, going into the law enforcement, trying to make people understand we're not getting all the kids in booster seats that need to be in booster seats. Yesterday I was in a kindergarten classroom talking to the kids about safety and talking about booster seats, and this is a classroom of about 25 kids, and I asked them how many of them were in booster seats. These are kindergartners. These are 5 and 6 year olds who weigh maybe 45 to 50 pounds. And I had 3 of them raise their hands that they were in booster seats. That means a good majority of those kids out there are being transported in vehicles with shoulder lap belts or lap belts only, and they're at major risk of being ejected out of their vehicles if there was a crash. These kids are in danger in our state. And this last year, we distributed about 250 car seats out of our program. We checked over 500. And we distributed 115 booster seats, and over 50% of those seats, the reason the people were getting those seats was because children were in nothing other than their seatbelt. And as an emergency room nurse, I have seen what tragedies can happen from not being properly restrained. And this legislation is nothing more than what we already have, other than the fact that it clarifies it. It helps the law enforcement officer when he makes a stop. Like was previously stated, he can ask them, How old is your child? Or is the multifamily seat that belt is going across their abdomen instead of the top of their hip? And if that belt cuts in through their abdomen, they're going to have all kinds of abdominal injuries. Or that belt keeps going and goes to the spine, and they have spinal injuries. So this will definitely help us in what we're trying to do on a day-to-day basis of getting these kids in booster seats. The other age group, that is pretty clear in our present statute, so that's not the issue, it's the booster seat. And on a national basis, we're always, they send out all these reports about who's in compliance with which regulations on seatbelts, and Alaska always falls out, because even though it says, according to federal standards, on a national basis, they do not recognize the state of Alaska as having a booster seat legislation. So again, this will help that, and also it will help the funding. But the bottom line, I guess, for me, is just the fact that please help us save some lives, these little kids. And thank you very much.
Just for the record, could you state, and I heard your statement, but could you say whether or not you're supportive of House Bill 218 or not?
Yes, I am very much in support of House Bill, okay. Or Senate Bill 218.
Thank you. Any questions for the presenter? If not, let's go. And thank you very much for your presentation today. Let's go to Anchorage to Gordon Glazier. Do you have more you would like to add, or is there a statement you'd like to present? Mr. Glazier, are you on?
Well, this is Gordon Glazier. I was hoping that Janice Tower could go on before me. She has a little, from the American Academy of Pediatrics local chapter, but she has a little tighter timeline than I do.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's fine. Peggy, and I don't know how to, Hayesha?
It's Peggy Hayashi, yes. Yeah, please let Janet go ahead.
Would you please, for the record, please then make your presentation for the committee?
Okay, thank you. My name is Janice Tower, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. On behalf of the Alaska Chapter AAP and the pediatricians in Alaska, I would like to lend our chapter support for Senate Bill 218 that would update and modernize our child safety seat laws to include the use of booster seats and to spell out specifically safe practices of child restraint devices that are appropriate for infants and children of all ages. Children should stay in a booster seat until an adult seat belt fits correctly, usually when a child reaches 4 feet 9 inches in height and is about 8 to 12 years of age. The Alaska Chapter AAP recommends that our child safety seat law is brought up to the standard. Results from a 2007 national survey of the use of booster seats conducted by the National Center of Statistics and Analysis for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration reveals alarmingly that booster seat use rates for children ages 6 and 7 actually dropped 36% in 2006 to 25% in 2007. The study goes on to conclude that there is a premature graduation of children from birth to age 12 to restraint types that are inappropriate for their height and their weight. I think that SB 218 will help alleviate some of this confusion. The bill would help parents and caregivers identify which safety devices are appropriate for their children. And certainly Alaska's pediatricians are happy to participate in education by doing their part counseling parents during doctor's visits on how to keep their children safe while riding in vehicles. Thank you.
Any questions for the presenter? If not, thank you for your presentation this afternoon. We'll go now to Gordon again. Gordon?
Okay. My name is Gordon Glazier. I'm with the State Division of Public Health, Injury Prevention, and Emergency Medical Services. And I guess just 2 points I want to make, because other people made excellent points. I want to add just two more. We have done child passenger safety checks where people voluntarily come in to have their car seats checked. Literally from Ketchikan to the North Pole. And all the places that we've gone, there's been the problem of parents not having their children correctly in their car seats, and specifically with those over 40 pounds not being in a booster seat. When we look at the data that comes from the Alaska Trauma Registry over a four-year period, of the 4 to 8 year olds over the this four-year period, 39 were injured. In other words, they had sufficient injuries that they had to be hospitalized overnight at an Alaskan hospital. None of the 39 were in a booster seat or child restraint. The hope of my understanding of this bill is that we will cut down on these admissions. And I'd be happy to answer any questions people might have.
Great, thank you. Any questions? If not, thank you for your presentation this afternoon, and we'll go to Peggy Hayashi.
Yes, this is Peggy Hayashi. I'm a registered nurse. I have been one for over 45 years now. I have been an emergency nurse for 42 of those years, and the coordinator for Safe Kids in Alaska prior to my retiring up until 2 years ago. Currently, I am the Child Passenger Safety Committee Chair for the state of Alaska, made up of instructors and technicians across the state. We look at data that they submit on a quarterly basis to the Alaska Injury Prevention Center that gives us a pretty good idea of what happens with our children who are in motor vehicles traveling across the state. It, as everyone has described, pretty discouraging when we see what happens to children over four. I've also sat with parents in emergency rooms who have told me more than once, as their children lie in the trauma room, either trying to be resuscitated or being treated for motor vehicle injuries, that they did not know or they did not understand what the law says. And as everyone has reiterated here, this is simply a clarification of our current law. This law was written in 1985 or around about that time, and we need to look at it, and we have done that over a period of almost 5 years now, trying to educate the public and law enforcement, and now we absolutely do need clarification. As a mother, a grandmother, and a healthcare provider for many years, I can't imagine anything worse than losing a child or having a child brain injured or severely injured for the rest of his life due to improper restraint in a car or lack of restraint in a car crash. I urge you, and I do support this, to go ahead and pass Senate Bill 218. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any questions for the presenter? If not, is there anybody else online that we have? No. Anybody else in the audience that feels they need to testify? If not, we'll close public testimony, and it's my intention to move the bill. What is the wish of the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, with regard to Senate Bill number 218, I would move that we pass this bill out of committee along with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objection? See no objection, then we will move this bill to the next committee of referral. Let's take it at ease to, for just 1 minute to sign the
Third, and we have before us Senate Bill 236, a transportation fund. Would you like to please identify yourself for the record and give us your presentation, please?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Frank Richards. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I'm here today to tell you about a fork in the road we're approaching with our transportation system. Today I will describe for you the state of Alaska's transportation system and how we are constrained in addressing our aging assets. I will describe for you what other states are doing with similar issues, particularly on their highways and roads, and present to you Governor Palin's approach to meeting the transportation needs in the future with an Alaska Transportation Fund. When we look at the existing infrastructure across Alaska, we see safety concerns across all of our modes, from fatal accidents on our roads and highways to seasonal closures of airports, which significantly impact the flow of goods and people into our rural villages. We see congestion impacting our larger communities, affecting everything from commuters to the movement of freight and school buses. And we see that our assets are deteriorating because we are unable to do the necessary prevention and preventative activities due to limited funding. As these photos of our highway pavements show, portions of our highways are in very poor condition. We estimate the backlog of pavement that has reached the end of its useful life is approaching $300 million on our national highway routes. This is approximately 2,100 miles of highways that include the Glenn Highway, the Parks, the Richardson, the Sterling, the Alaska, and the Dalton highways. We estimate the pavement deterioration on these routes alone is growing at a rate of almost $80 million a year. Other routes, such as the Alaska Highway System and the Community Transportation Program, which include locally owned roads, are in addition to this need. We estimate that for every dollar of timely pavement life cycle investment, we can save almost $4 of extensive repair costs. This is very hard to put into place with such a large backlog of already nearly failed pavements. We also have challenges with our bridges. Although we've been making good progress towards bridge repairs, we are by no means done with the job. For example, we've completed work or will complete work on Washington Creek Bridge, several Parks Highway bridges, Hicks Creek, the Kenai River Bridge in Soldotna, and the South Channel Bridge in Unalaska. The Tanana River Bridge on the Alaska Highway and bridges in Hyder and Gustavus are scheduled for projects this year. That's if we can obtain the necessary environmental permits to complete that work. As the slide denotes, about 10% of our bridges need seismic retrofits. This work includes lengthening bearing sets, cabling girders together, anchoring the bridges to their supports, and strengthening the columns and footings. To date, I believe we've spent almost $20 million doing this work, and we're not yet done. We've done what we can for what we call phase one, getting most bang for the buck. However, we need to continue this work over the next few years and complete phase two, which will be much more expensive and will only be able to do one or two projects per year. Across the state, our transportation assets are also being impacted by changing climatic conditions. We are seeing and experiencing heavy precipitation events, greater frequency of strong storms, warmer summers, and extended shoulder seasons, both spring and fall, that are increasing the number of freeze-thaw cycles that our assets are experiencing.
I see a... How long is your presentation?
It's...
Yeah, you know what I want to do? I want to go to the bill.
You want to go? Okay.
Like to, we understand the problem. We've all seen it. We've all been there.
Okay.
Let's go to the bill and talk about what the bill does and what your intention is to have the bill before us and to go forward on it.
Okay, Mr.
Unless there are members of the committee that want to see the slide presentation, I think we've got the gist of it already just with the first five slides.
Okay, very well. I appreciate that. I'm glad that you understand the issue that we face across the state. I believe in the audience we have our Administrative Services Director, Nancy Slagle, and we have representatives from the Department of Law as well as Revenue. So if there are particular questions on the bill, I guess I would refer to those subject matter experts to address.
Okay, let's go ahead and do that. And as I understand the bill, then what we're doing is we're putting a transportation fund that'll be an endowment. And why don't you go ahead and describe the bill for
okay,
us?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, what the governor has proposed is essentially two installments into an endowment fund, $500 million in fiscal year 08 and $500 million in fiscal year 09 to create a corpus of about $1 billion. That fund would be invested through Department of Revenue and its investment schemes, and the interest earned off of that fund would then be used to fund the transportation needs across the state. So those funds would be utilized to address all modal issues that we have out there, from ports and harbors, airports, highway type of assets. It would be a fund source that the legislature would appropriate to cover specific projects that we would nominate through our capital budget process.
Are we being asked to adopt the fiscal note? Because I see the fiscal note has zeros all the way across the bottom. I mean, I heard you mention $500 million this year and $500 million last year. Seems to me if we're going to do that, we ought to have a fiscal note in there someplace that says that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to refer to my admin services director to answer that question.
Okay. I mean, I'm all for adopting this bill with a zero fiscal note, but if that's not what you want, we ought to talk about that.
For the record, I'm Nancy Slagle, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
I almost have an old fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, what I would expect that there would be is an appropriation specifically for the $500 million to capitalize the fund.
Mm-hmm.
This, basically what you have in front of you is the bill that creates the fund. And so
even this
I think the
even
fiscal
this
impact to the zero fiscal note that the department is bringing forward is basically saying that we are going to administer the program of issuing or identifying projects within our existing framework, within our existing organization. But you're right, and I'm probably, Jerry, the appropriation bill?
There's an appropriation bill.
Which is separate from this.
Okay, that's good to know, and I appreciate that information, because what we're going to do then is we're going to establish the fund through this bill, and then an appropriation bill will come along behind it to fund it.
That's right.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you put this endowment together and you got $1 billion in there, and we're already having trouble with things like the permanent fund, making it so that people from outside of Alaska look at it askew, is this going to make us ineligible or decrease our ability to go and get federal funds for any of these big projects like bridges and extensive pavement repairs?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, no, this will not impact our ability to get funds from the Federal Highway Administration or the Federal Aviation Administration for our regular programs. It does not impact our eligibility for any of those funds. Many other states are trying to deal with the issue of constraints on the federal funds and taking a variety of approaches to dealing with that through increasing fuel taxes, bonding, toll revenues, a variety of methods. And this is an approach that the governor felt was appropriate for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that we didn't need to go through the whole thing, but there were a couple slides. If I could just ask them to flip forward, and I think it'd be helpful for the committee just to get a sense of where you're trying to go and the reasons why. To go to page 9, let's see, one more, I think. That's my page 9, slide 17. Yes, right there. So I think it's helpful to see what other states have done. And somewhere in here I read, and is it true that we're the only state in the nation that doesn't have a general fund component like this? Did I read that or did I hear that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, that is correct. All 49 other states have a transportation fund.
So knowing that, I wonder if you'd walk us through 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and then I think 26 is important also. So just a little background on why we're doing this.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I'd be glad to. As you see on slide 17, Alaska has been extremely fortunate to receive almost $6.44 of Federal Highway Administration funds for every dollar that we pay in at the gas, at the fuel tank, fuel pump. In 2010 will be the year for the reauthorization of the highway bill. We expect it to be very different in this next bill than what we have received in previous bills, because the emphasis is going to be on greenhouse gas reduction. In some areas, it's already being called green tea. So that means that likely, as a recipient state, we will likely see a significant reduction in the amount of dollars that we are getting. The new national commission that was created under Safety Lou that was charged to look at the next reauthorization and the funding mechanisms therein just released its report last week, and they propose a complete makeover of the entire federal transportation system. And we'll replace the formula approach, which we've been a great recipient of, to it with a performance measure approach with oversight by this said national committee.
What you just said is that the expectation is that the money coming to us from offshore is going to be less.
That is correct, Senator.
Not more.
That is
okay.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
This slide here depicts essentially what other states have been receiving in terms of and how they are funding their transportation needs within their states. As the pie chart shows, other states fund approximately 70% to 80% of their transportation needs utilizing funds that they collect through the fees and structures that Nancy talked about earlier with their own gas taxes, tolls, public-private partnerships, etc., and rely on only 20 to 30% of the federal funding that they have for their programs. And I must also note that in those states, their highway systems that they have, the state responsibilities only represent about 20% of the roads and highways in those states, where in Alaska, the state ownership is about 40% of the public roads that we have. So almost twice as much. 19. Well, as Nancy said, tolls, public-private partnerships, and user fees for vehicle mile driven are current concepts that are being put into place by other states and creating revenues for those. We see that these types of fundings would be essentially difficult to institute in Alaska with our small population base to generate a significant amount of revenue. If I may, slide 20, okay?
Yeah, I think this is okay. Important.
Mm-hmm. Right. There are what we call strategic advantages to having a state-funded program. Namely, we can complete the projects much faster, which equates to it being much, much less costly overall. Why? Because we have relief from some of the onerous federal oversight and do not have to follow as many of the federal laws that I showed on the previous slides that I showed that are in your packet that show a tremendous amount of federal laws that when federal funds are spent must be complied with. Examples are the NEPA process, Section 4F. NEPA is avoided when there are no federal actions involved, such as wetlands permits. Thus, many of our preventative maintenance and major maintenance type projects would enjoy relief from having to go through the NEPA process. And 4F is a law specific to US DOT funds and applies to recreational, refuge, and historic properties. And it can be extremely demanding to meet its requirements and can often thwart common sense. This is a very telling slide, and it identifies a typical project, the top project being a federal timeline of approximately 7 years. And you'll notice that each phase of the project in a federal program must be completed before the next phase can begin. So environmental, which averages almost 2 to 3 years in time, must be complete before we can conduct our right-of-way phase, and then our design phase, and then our right-of-way phase before getting into construction. The benefit of a state-funded program is that we can do many of these same processes in parallel, thus saving considerable amount of time. And we have experienced that with some of our general funded projects, saving almost 2 to 3 years off of what would normally have been a 7+ year timeline. And that time, as I said earlier, equates to money, because we're able to get the projects done And these are some examples of some of those successes. The Dalton Highway, saving almost 3 years. The Elmore Road, which was the Abbott Loop Extension, saving almost 2 years. And then our McCarthy Road project, which saved almost 3 years. Very substantial time savings, and again, equating to money.
If there was some federal funds in that, would that slow down those projects? Because those were not, wasn't there some federal dollars in any of those?
These are all state GF projects.
All of them are, okay.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that there are some federal projects along the Dalton Highway, but these are what we're pinpointing here are the state-funded only projects. And there was a federal project on McCarthy that was started, but
comes back, we can
to do an EIS, but was determined that not to go forward with that project.
Okay.
Senator Wilken, was there another slide that you wanted me to address?
I thought it was on slide 26. It answered the question. I don't think the need for this is clear. It's just how we're going to do it. And, of course, people always fall back to, well, we'll just collect more on our gas tax. And there you've addressed that right there. So would you talk about slide 26?
Okay. This is essentially why our approach. We feel that, and we know, the individual project appropriations don't allow us to develop a programmatic approach. In lean years, where we have had low revenues coming into the state, we've had relatively small levels of appropriation. This causes a challenge to not only us as the owner of the assets, but also for our contracting community and our design communities, because there's not work that is then going out to those guys to keep their skills honed and their equipment working. So we see a systematic impact to our construction as well as our engineering communities by not having a consistent approach so that we can keep the work flowing and keep folks employed. We feel that the $50 million that we estimate will be generated by the Alaska Transportation Fund would give us then the ability to have that systematic approach. We could build a program. We would have money to start the design of a project and not have the money as in an individual appropriation locked up until we go through the design, the right-of-way, the environmental, and actually the construction phase. Because we see as we get those individual appropriations, what we estimate in year one for a project, by year five, because of the high cost inflation that we've experienced, we don't have enough money and we have to come back and seek additional monies. With a program, we would have the ability within that program to cover those increased costs by shifting from one project to another. And we felt that that would be a substantial savings, but also it allows us to be more efficient. And it's similar to what we're doing with our Federal Highway Administration and our Federal Aviation Administration programs. And we feel that those are good examples. The one thing that I would note is that to raise an equivalent amount of money, $50 million, would mean that we would have to raise our existing gas tax 150%, going from 8 cents to 20 cents. And the citizens of the state, as you all know, are somewhat adverse to taxes, and that was just an approach that the governor was not willing to undertake.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you. And $50 million is conservative. If you have a billion-dollar endowment, you're conservatively saying $50 million.
I think that's just the initial revenue stream that we would see in probably the first year, but then as we inflation proof it and see the principal grow, we would see more money coming out of the.
Okay. Any questions for the presenters today? If not, thank you very much for your presentation. We'll go on. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify?
This is Senator Caffrey.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah, I was just wondering how would you envision prioritization
of these projects being funded from the funds. Would you use the current STIP process for another process, and have you addressed the Marion Highway system? Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, we would develop a listing of projects similar to the STIP that would be both, well, would be the state-funded list of projects across the modal needs. And In individual years, we would submit those projects through the capital budget to the legislature for appropriation using the fund receipts out of the Alaska Transportation Fund.
What about the Marine Highway?
Well, the Marine Highway would be is one of the transportation modes that we have and would be eligible to receive funds from this.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If there's nobody else in the audience, we'll go to online, and we'll go first to Anchorage, to Avis Thompson from the Alaska Trucking Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Aves Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. And the Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing trucking interests from Barrow to Ketchikan. In 2008, our association celebrates its 50th anniversary of serving the interests of the trucking industry in Alaska. Our more than 200 member companies represent all of the diverse trucking operations in the state, along with many associate members who provide goods and services to our industry. In Alaska, trucking employs over 21,000 people, one out of every 14 civilian workers. Trucking pays more than $928 million in wages annually and consists of several thousand family-owned and corporate trucking businesses, most having fewer than 10 employees. As you can see, the trucking industry makes a huge contribution to the economy of Alaska in terms of jobs and economic impact. The simple truth is that if you got it, a truck brought it. One of the priorities of the ATA is and has been to expand the DOT and PF State General Fund Capital Projects Program, and it's clear that federal funding will not meet Alaska's transportation infrastructure needs in the near nor in the longer term future. Given our enormous tax increase in, or our enormous increase in tax revenue, Alaska needs to invest some of our dollars in our transportation system. Based on our position that we need to invest in our transportation infrastructure, we feel that the idea of the Transportation Endowment Fund has merit. While the devil is in the details, this endowment fund may very well serve as a primary funding source to enable a significant expansion of the State General Fund Transportation Capital Projects Program. Speaking of the devil, we note that in the bill on page 1, line 13 and 14, that, quote, the amount identified in sub A of this section is available for appropriation to the capital projects fund identified in AS44.42.080(2). This reference is to a fund entitled Transportation and Related Facilities. This is a broad title that covers a lot of different projects. While we are all well-intentioned, we have seen what has happened to the Federal Highway Trust Fund over the past years. The Highway Trust Fund has been depleted for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the very heavy demand placed on the Highway Trust Fund by other than highway projects. We are told by both state and federal DOTs that the Federal Highway Trust Fund will run out of money sometime in 2009. Realizing that there are other modes of travel than highway, it seems to us that our highway system currently serves by far the largest portion of our population. Freight movement, tourist travel, and personal travel are on the rise, and the demands on our highway system will only continue to grow exponentially. This is the long way of saying that we believe that the largest share of the project dollars made available through this fund need to be directed toward our highway system. We want to be sure that our current and future highway needs are met, particularly during this time of prosperity. Non-highway projects need to be considered on their own merit after seeking other state or federal funding sources. In Alaska, there are two major highway systems, the National Highway System and the Alaska State Highway System. The National Highway System, or the NHS, as Deputy Commissioner Richards alluded to, is a system of intercity connecting routes that link communities and workplaces in our state. These are the major routes that carry a large portion of all the freight delivered in Alaska. The state highway system is the system of secondary segments that provide further links to our communities. The NHS is the system of vital arteries that enable people and goods to move freely throughout the system. Our major highway project funding efforts need to be directed at a modern, safe, and efficient system of highways to support and encourage current and future economic development to provide for the maximum benefit for our citizens. The transportation fund earnings can help support both NHS and AHS projects, as well as important local projects. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, the Alaska Trucking Association supports Senate Bill 236 and the Transportation Endowment Fund concept. We believe it is an appropriate and necessary use of state funds that will pay dividends well beyond our lifetime. We are hopeful that the fund will grow in size and in earnings in the future to ensure that our highways meet Alaska's needs. Thank you, and I will try to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions for the presenter? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. We'll now go to Matsu and Cindy Bettine, I believe is Matsu Assembly.
Hello, my name is Cindy Bettini, and I'm a member of the Matsu Borough Assembly. I represent District 5, which has two of the most dangerous roads in the state, according to DOT, based on accidents and deaths. I am calling in to support this endowment, and I would just like to say that I would even support more money for this endowment. I think the assistant borough manager is going to testify with a lot of the situations that we are here in Matsu, not only because we've been the fast-growing area of the state for probably more than a decade, but we have a third of the state roads in the Matsu borough. Also, I just wanted to note that in the Matsu borough, we do have road service areas, and our taxpayers are contributing over $10 million a year in maintenance as well as capital projects on our borough local roads, which, because of our population growth and the overuse of state roads, our local roads are really taking a beating, because what were originally developed for residential subdivisions are now used for shortcuts between state roads. And so we're get tech curve there as well. But anyway, I just wanted to call and say that I support the bill and hope that the funding will be more than $6 million a year. One of our roads, trunk roads that has been on the state list of priorities for over 20 years has escalated in cost to over $40 million. The right-of-way is purchased, the utilities have been moved. All we need is for the dirt to be moved. So I thank you very much for this opportunity, and I hope that you will pass this down plan on. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there questions from the committee? If not, we'll move on to Marion Romano from the Matsu Borough.
Hello, this is Marion Romano, Assistant Borough Manager for the Matsu Borough. Are you hearing me?
Yes, we hear you fine. Thank you. Would you make your presentation, please?
Yes. We're delighted that the governor has been forward-thinking and seen some long-term solutions to state funding for roads in Alaska, especially in light of the fact that federal funds are disappearing. While we think this is an excellent idea, it's really not enough to meet either the present needs of our state, in fact, not even the Matsu Borough. As you probably all know, and as Bettini said, we're the fastest growing area in the state, has been for many years, and will probably continue to be. But what you may not know is a third of the entire state's network is in the Matsu Borough, that we have three of the most dangerous roads in the state in our borough, and that is taken from accident data from DOT. We've already had five fatalities in the month of January on state roads. And our recent long-range transportation plan shows that we need $1.5 billion over the next 20 years just to prevent gridlock. That would more than take everything that's being spun off this transportation fund as it's currently structured. This doesn't even begin to look at the fact that asphalt and steel have tripled in price over recent few years, and right-of-way acquisition, at least in the Matthew borough, has doubled. We have some specific real problems, like Seward Meridian Highway. We've already spent $12 million on Seward Meridian. We've identified the right-of-way, but now there's no money to purchase the right-of-way, which puts homeowners in a position where they can't sell their houses because nobody's going to buy a house that's going to be taken out, so they can't afford to buy another house because they haven't the funds from this one. This requires $12 million. Trunk Road, as Ms. Bettini also mentioned, it's a critical north-south artery for us. It's been on the list for over 20 years. This provides access to our new hospital, to our college, which is currently expanding and beginning to take on four-year programs. This is $20 million alone. I mean, together, those two projects are $32 million. It's not a reasonable expectation that all of that would come to the Mat-Su, even though the need is intense. Our Connect Goose Bay Road, the population of that area is enough to be considered the fifth largest city in the state, just in the Connecticut Bay Road area. This is the main access road to the Connick Arm Crossing and the main access road to the new state prison. DOT doesn't even have us on their list for planning. I mean, there's so many projects that need to happen here in the Mat-Su. That now, the two-lane road, it is intensely overcrowded. We're looking for $3 million simply for the design of that road. When you look at the bigger picture, I'd like to point out that we as a borough are taxing ourselves to meet our own needs. We have a local contribution of over $6 million in our local road service areas alone. We work with DOT to provide borough connector roads. Otherwise, the Park Highway extension in Big Lake wouldn't even happen because there is not enough money to put frontage roads. So the borough sort of has jumped in and said, okay, what can we do to help? We provide borough gravel for free to help DOT get more miles for their money out of roads in the Mat-Su. And we're asking for you to consider the contributions that communities like ours make, and that maybe in addition to this transportation fund, which we hope would be much larger, you might consider perhaps matching programs to recognize communities' willingness to use their own resources to help improve their areas. And I think about how you might prioritize, whether that's need or growth, and I'm afraid the match is going to come out on top, and it's going to need everything that's spun off as the fund is currently situated. So we're certainly asking that you consider a bigger fund or some things in addition to the funds until the fund is not additional dollars. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the presenter? Seeing none, is there anybody else in the audience that needs to testify or would like to testify? We'll close public testimony, and it's my intention to move this bill. What's the wish of the committee?
Move to report Senate Bill 236 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. Is there an objection? Here no objection, then the bill is moved, and having nothing else on our agenda, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Good job.